In the dog days of summer 1922, something strange was happening around the sleepy lakeside village of Bridgman, Michigan. A large number of men and a few women had gathered at Carl Wolfskeel's little resort out by the dunes. They claimed to be a singing society, but there wasn't much singing to be heard. They rented the whole place and kept strictly to themselves. Still, a really nosy person might have noticed their nighttime gatherings in a wooded hollow. Numbering almost 50, the mysterious visitors talked and argued for hours, not always in English. All the while, others furiously banged away at typewriters. The whole scene was bathed in yellow lantern glow. What almost no one would have guessed was that they were watching the secret convention of the American Communist Party. Something that legally didn't exist. A year earlier, dogged by government harassment, the Communist Party had basically cloned itself. It created two parties with overlapping membership. The new Workers' Party of America was spun off to conduct political activity, all according to the letter of the law. Meanwhile, the former Communist Party went underground to carry on preparations for a revolution. In this work, the American Reds were closely guided by the so-called Communist International, or Comintern, headquartered in Moscow. 2 years prior, the Communists had pulled off an earlier secret convention at the same Wolfskeel's resort. And in the meantime, they'd conducted two other clandestine gatherings in upstate New York. The party's central committee, the Inner Sanctum, was confident in its rigorous security. The comrades traveled by different routes, repeatedly changing trains. Few even knew that they were headed to Bridgman until they got there. At the lodge, no one could leave without permission, nor send any messages, or talk to the locals. Everyone had aliases, and no one asked real names. Any incriminating papers were handed to the Central Committee, which either burned them or hid them in barrels out in the dunes. So, who were these communists hiding from? The answer? Agents of the U.S. government, especially the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Yet a government agent was sitting right in their midst. His code name was K-97. To his party pals, he was known as Comrade Day. The main business of this secret convention wasn't plotting revolution, but rather healing factional rifts. To oversee that, Moscow's Communist International, the Red Holy of Holies, had sent over special emissaries. Leading them was a veteran Polish Bolshevik, Henryk Walecki. Assisting him were a Russian-American dentist named Boris Reinstein from Buffalo, New York, and a Hungarian, Joseph Pogani, alias John Pepper. Pogani also represented the Soviet secret police. The Americans' factional disputes needed to be fixed because in a week's time, the Workers' Party of America was going to hold its convention in Chicago. While the Workers' Party presented a democratic front to the world, the Underground Party called all the shots. Comrade Day's real name was Francis Morrow. He'd started out as a party organizer in New Jersey. Disgusted by factional squabbling, he became a federal informant. Before reaching Bridgman, Morrow managed to get a message to Washington from his last stop, the nearby town of St. Joseph. The Bureau immediately dispatched one of its best agents, Jacob Spolansky, to track down the convention's precise location. On Sunday, August 20th, Spolansky and another agent posed as vacationers and wandered on to the Wolfskeel's property. Finding the guests less than talkative, Spolansky knew he'd found the right spot. He contacted the local sheriff and laid plans for a raid. But the appearance of the outsiders spooked the commies at the lodge. They burned or buried their papers and began to slip away. By the time law enforcement raided the site on the morning of August 22nd, only 17 comrades remained. Morrow was one. Another was the General Secretary of the Workers' Party, Charles Ruthenberg. The Soviet reps got away clean. Ruthenberg and a few others later stood trial for criminal syndicalism, but the arrest did little to damage the party or its leadership. What they did was prove that the Workers' Party was nothing but a front and that the Underground Party was fully controlled by the Soviet-led Communist International, or Comintern. The Comintern had been formed in Moscow in March 1919 to pursue Vladimir Lenin's goal of world revolution. Lenin grandly predicted that through the Comintern, an international Soviet republic would be a reality by 1920. Things didn't go according to plan, but Lenin wasn't going to stop trying. He commanded the Comintern to create a whole solar system of organizations and smaller committees around the Communist Party and working under the influence of the party. The most important of these would be mass organizations sympathizing with our aims and able to aid us for special purposes. During the 1920s and 30s, the Comintern's master of propaganda was a German communist named Willy Münzenberg, dubbed the Red Millionaire. Münzenberg became a media tycoon who controlled newspapers, magazines, film studios, publishing houses, and even orphanages. He created front organizations that abetted and concealed communist activity. Münzenberg realized that control of the media was key to effective propaganda. Using the Kremlin's money, lots of it, he built a trust of media outlets reaching all the way to America and even to the Far East. But Münzenberg didn't believe that being a communist meant foregoing the finer things in life. Comintern money also supported his lavish personal lifestyle. Born the same year as Adolf Hitler, Münzenberg met Lenin in Switzerland during World War I. One of Münzenberg's first creations for the Bolsheviks was the Young Communist International, the Comintern's youth wing. In 1921, Münzenberg set up shop in Berlin, where he formed the International Workers' Aid Organization. Its official aim was to collect foreign aid for famine victims in Soviet Russia. But it also diverted some of those funds to propaganda. In the United States, workers' aid spun off another front, the Friends of Soviet Russia, which collected more than $1 million for the cause. The three pillars of Münzenberg's propaganda were anti-militarism, anti-imperialism, and anti-fascism. This attracted far more than communists, and that was the whole point. Münzenberg dubbed his fronts innocence clubs. The less charitable called them dupes or useful idiots. In any case, it was absolutely essential that such fellow travelers believe that they were acting on their own initiative and not under the guidance of the Comintern. And that belief had to be preserved at any price. One example of a highly successful innocence club was the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League. It was organized in the mid-1930s by one of Münzenberg's most skilled operatives, the Czech-born Comintern agent, Otto Katz. Katz presented himself as a cynical, if charming, international playboy, and he quickly made friends in Tinseltown. Famous names including James Cagney, Friedrich March, and Dorothy Parker stumped for the Anti-Nazi League, just as Münzenberg hoped they would. But for all his devotion to the Red cause, Münzenberg hated Stalin, and Stalin suspected him of Trotskyite sympathies. In 1936, the infamous purge trials commenced in Moscow. Some months later, Münzenberg openly proclaimed himself an anti-Stalinist and fled to Paris. He was still there when Hitler invaded France in 1940. Keeping one step ahead of the Germans, Münzenberg vanished. Later, his decomposed body was found in the woods in southern France. The official verdict was suicide, but there's little doubt that the Red Octopus, in the guise of Stalin's assassins, had exacted its revenge. In Germany, another key communist operative was the Jewish-Ukrainian Bolshevik Karl Radek. During World War I, Radek was close to the shadowy revolutionary financier and German agent Alexander Helpand Parvus. And Radek learned a lot from Parvus. But Radek had a snarky wit that made him enemies. He joined up with Lenin in 1915, maybe on Parvus's orders. Once back in Russia in 1917, Radek attached himself to Parvus's former protege, Leon Trotsky, and served as Trotsky's deputy in peace negotiations with the Germans. Late in 1918, after the German Kaiser's fall, Radek helped organize the German Communist Party. Arrested by the new German Weimar government, Radek spent 1919 sitting in a Berlin jail cell. But he was no ordinary prisoner. Radek virtually held court in his cell, receiving a constant stream of visitors, including politicians, military officers, industrialists, and spies. After returning to Russia, Radek became secretary of the Comintern. He advocated cooperation with right-wing, even proto-Nazi elements in Germany to form a common national Bolshevik front. To Radek, the German rightists were more useful idiots. With or without the Kremlin's approval, Radek secretly backed an abortive right-wing coup against the Weimar Republic in 1920, the so-called Kapp-Putsch. Despite his Jewish ancestry, Radek urged German rightists to fight Jewish capitalists and hang them from the lampposts. After several failed attempts to seize power, the German communists, like their American comrades, outwardly disavowed violent revolution. They vowed to seek power legally, but they were simply following the Comintern's instructions. Like the Americans, German communists created a secret organization that carried on the revolutionary struggle. It specialized in infiltrating the German military and police. It also prepared combat units for armed revolt and created cells to handle sabotage, arson, and assassinations. All this frenetic activity did little to stop the rise and triumph of the Nazis. One reason was that the German communist masters in Moscow decided that it was tactically expedient to let the Hitlerites finish off the Weimar Republic. Radek, as a Trotsky ally, ran afoul of Stalin and was booted from the party in 1927. In 1929, he recanted and betrayed some of Trotsky's agents. It didn't save him. Tried again in Moscow in 1937, Radek dodged the firing squad by again betraying former comrades. He still got 10 years in the gulag and was murdered there, presumably on Stalin's orders. German intrigues were the launching pad for another agent of the Red Octopus, Soviet journalist Semyon Rostovsky. Under a new name, Ernst Henri, Rostovsky popped up in London in 1933. His job was talent scout for Soviet intelligence. He soon turned his attention to Oxford and Cambridge, the finishing schools of the British establishment. These universities graduated the British Empire's future politicians, diplomats, military officers, and spies. Cambridge already had an active communist movement. It included members of an ultra-elite intellectual society known as the Apostles. Henri had a hand in recruiting at least three apostles as future Soviet spies, Guy Burgess, Anthony Blunt, and John Cairncross. They led him to others, including the most successful and devastating of the lot, Kim Philby, arguably Britain's premier traitor. Meanwhile, back in the United States, the Russian-born Julius Hammer was a prominent New York physician who owned a chain of drugstores and a thriving pharmaceutical business. He also earned money as an abortionist to Gotham's well-to-do. All the while, he and his sons secretly served the communist cause. Hammer was a devout socialist and one of the founders of the Communist Party of America, and he gave generously to the cause. In 1917, Hammer helped Leon Trotsky, then visiting the United States, to find housing in the Bronx, and even lent his chauffeured car to ferry Mrs. Trotsky and the kids around town. By 1919, Hammer's radical activism had attracted the attention of the U.S. government. That year, he was arrested and sentenced to Sing Sing prison for causing the death of a woman through a botched abortion. Hammer claimed that political persecution was behind the arrest, and it's unclear whether the deadly abortion was performed by Julius or his son Armand, who was then a medical student. In 1921, Armand went to Moscow in his father's stead, carrying a letter of introduction to Lenin. Later, joined by brothers Victor and Harry, and still later by Dad, Armand spent most of the 1920s living the high life as a capitalist prince in the workers' paradise. All this took place under Lenin's New Economic Policy, or NEP, which permitted some free enterprise and encouraged foreigners to set up businesses in partnership with the communist regime. The Hammers dabbled in everything from medicines to pencils and even an asbestos mine. They even managed to become exclusive agents for Ford Motor Company in the USSR. But the Hammer boys were indifferent businessmen. Most of their ventures flopped. Then, at the end of the 1920s, Stalin shut down the NEP. Armand, arguably the cleverest of the bunch, found another angle, taking part in what historian Sean McMeekin calls the world's greatest heist. The Bolsheviks had exhausted what remained of the once mighty Russian gold reserve. They needed to sell valuables, especially gems and artworks, to raise the hard currency they needed to fund the Comintern operations abroad. So they looted palaces, churches, museums, and private homes, confiscating anything and everything of value. Armand became their fence. Hammer found buyers for this swag among America's wealthy. That made him friends in high places, including presidents, and offered more opportunities. Armand eventually became chairman of the Occidental Petroleum Company. Hammer's biographer Edward J. Epstein has labeled him a virtual spy. A more accurate term would be agent of influence. That's an intelligence operative whose primary job is not to spy, but to influence policy by shaping opinions and perceptions. That relied mostly on personal connections. Whether or not Armand shared his father's ideological convictions, he willingly served the Red Octopus as a loyal member of a secret society. And Armand wasn't the only one of his kind. Russian-American businessman Alexander Gumberg played a similar role through the 1920s and 30s. Gumberg started out in 1917 when he insinuated himself into the American Red Cross mission in Russia as a translator and spy. Gumberg's brother, Sergei Zorin, was a high-ranking Bolshevik who hosted the Comintern's Second Congress in 1920. Zorin later ended up shot as a Trotskyite. Another agent of influence was Baroness Mora Budberg, a supposed white Russian emigre who successfully wormed her way into the confidence and beds of authors H.G. Wells and Maxim Gorky and filmmaker Alexander Korda. The Hammers might have a connection to a curious incident in 1925 in upstate New York. A year earlier, the Soviets had opened a trade bureau called AMTORG in New York City. Because Moscow and Washington did not maintain diplomatic relations, AMTORG functioned as a quasi-diplomatic outpost and as a base of operations for the Comintern and Soviet intelligence. Moscow sent an experienced, if undistinguished, Bolshevik apparatchik named Isaiah Hurgin to lead the AMTORG operation. Hurgin was also so successful, he threatened to put the Hammers out of business. So, in July 1925, Julius Hammer took his complaint straight to Trotsky, who had recently assumed a post overseeing foreign concessions in the USSR. The following month, Trotsky's right-hand man, Ephraim Sklyansky, arrived in New York. Sklyansky's official mission was to negotiate cotton and wool contracts, but nobody really believed that. Among other things, Sklyansky and Trotsky were close allies and shared a hatred of Stalin. So some suspected that Sklyansky had come to America on Trotsky's orders to turn AMTORG into a base of conspiratorial action against Stalin. That's what Stalin may have suspected. As soon as Sklyansky stepped off the boat, he collected Hurgin and other AMTORG officials and set off for Long Lake. Nestled deep in the Adirondacks, the tiny summer resort was one of the most isolated spots in the Empire State. And isolation meant secrecy. The AMTORG group took up residence at the local Sagamore Hotel. To anyone who asked, they were on holiday and just planned to stay a few days. But Long Lake was a long way to go for a little rest and relaxation. There was more going on. Later Soviet press reports called the Long Lake gathering a conference of senior officials of Soviet institutions in the United States. What officials? What institutions? What was the meeting about? There were other Russians at the hotel, but no one could later recall who or how many. If this sounds familiar, recall that the 1922 Bridgman Convention that opened this lecture took place at another isolated resort at the same time of year. Coincidentally, although you can bet it wasn't a coincidence, just as Sklyansky and the others reached Long Lake, the underground American communists were holding their annual meeting in Chicago. And again, the Comintern sent an emissary to oversee the convention. He was Sergei Gusev, a loyal Stalinist whose main job was to purge Trotskyism from the American party. Gusev knew and loathed Sklyansky. Gusev headed the Soviet party's Central Control Commission, which controlled party discipline. Think purges and punishments. Think another secret society within a secret society. Meanwhile, back at Long Lake, on the afternoon of August the 27th, 1925, Sklyansky, Hourgan, and a few others decided to venture out on the water. That was odd because the weather was unseasonably cold and a strong wind was whipping up white caps on the lake. Sklyansky and Hourgan piled into a canoe and the others followed in a rowboat. Sklyansky also brought along a briefcase full of papers, just the thing for a canoe trip in rough weather. The canoe soon left the rowboat behind and then unexpectedly headed across the lake. The others lost sight of it in the swells. A few hours later, the capsized canoe and the drowned corpses of Sklyansky and Hourgan were found on the opposite shore. One eyewitness recalled that immediately after the bodies were recovered, a group of mysterious Russians appeared to retrieve the briefcase. The official verdict is that it was all a terrible accident. But in Moscow, the rumor quickly spread that it was murder and Stalin was behind it. A man like Sergei Gusev could have and would have arranged Sklyansky's death, but that's not to say he did. And let's not forget Julius Hammer and Sons, whose kingdom of greed was directly threatened by Sklyansky and Hourgan. Julius Hammer had met some hard cases in Sing Sing prison. Did he arrange the hit? In all likelihood, the drowning of Sklyansky and his companion was an accident. But it was an accident caused by inexplicable recklessness or desperation. Were Sklyansky and Hourgan trying to escape from someone? And what was in the briefcase? Were they there to meet with someone? Was the Long Lake meeting a cover for a secret Trotskyist conclave? In the years to come, Stalin exploited fear of a vast Trotskyite conspiracy within the party to unleash mass terror in the infamous Moscow show trials. But did a Trotskyite secret society even exist? Today, it's taken for granted that the charges against the later show trial defendants were all phony and their confessions forced. But the reality is probably more complicated. Trotsky did have loyalists in the party, and he maintained secret communication with many of them after his expulsion from the USSR in 1929. On some level, this certainly involved conspiracy against Stalin. Shortly before Trotsky's expulsion from the USSR, he received a letter from someone in New York identified as Abram. In a coded attachment, Abram mentioned plans to spirit Trotsky out of Russia and set up special bank accounts for him in New York, a war chest. After his exile, Trotsky enlisted a star agent of Soviet intelligence named Yakov Blumkin. Blumkin was personally devoted to Trotsky and agreed to carry a message back to Moscow for Trotsky's former protege, Karl Radek. But the unreliable Radek betrayed Blumkin, who ended up in front of a firing squad. Nowhere did the red octopus spread its tentacles wider and deeper than in the United States. Prior to World War II, America possessed almost no domestic counterintelligence. In 1929, the American Communist Party emerged from the underground and reabsorbed the Workers' Party. But along with its card-carrying comrades, the party also had a secret group of members. Benjamin Gitlow, a prominent American communist during the early 20th century, said this secret membership is known only to the Central Executive Committee, perhaps only to the Political Committee, and in some cases, only to the Secretariat. In other words, only to the party's highest initiates. One example was the noted American civil rights attorney Joseph Brodsky, not to be confused with a Russian-born American writer of the same name. As a legal counselor for Willy Munzenberg's International Labor Defense, Brodsky participated in the high-profile Sacco and Vanzetti murder case and the racially motivated Scottsboro Boys rape trial. Brodsky publicly denied any connection to the Communist Party. In reality, he held a position of highest confidence in it, though only a handful of comrades were aware of this. Party faithful, especially the secret faithful, provided ready and willing recruits for special tasks. Many became servants of the most secret society in international communism, Soviet intelligence. Benjamin Gitlow noted that the Comintern maintained very close ties with the Soviet secret services and assisted them in foreign countries. One example was Nick Dosenberg, a veteran Bolshevik and naturalized American citizen. He was recruited by the GRU, or Soviet Military Intelligence, in 1927. The GRU first sent him to Romania, where he set up the American Romanian Film Company. Returning to the States, Dosenberg's company became a cover for other Soviet agents and the center of an ambitious scheme to pass counterfeit U.S. currency. When that collapsed, Dosenberg got a new identity and headed to China. In 1939, the FBI finally caught up with him in Oregon, where he was quietly running another business. Stalin unceremoniously abolished the Comintern in 1943. Partly, this was a wartime gesture to his new American and British allies, and partly because, for Stalin, the organization carried the stench of Trotskyism. But this did nothing to slow down Soviet intelligence and its infiltration of the U.S. and British governments. Behind the mask of wartime Allied solidarity, Soviet clandestine activity actually accelerated. One person who started to suspect something was Army Intelligence Officer Carter Clark. Clark oversaw a select and very hush-hush band of military cryptologists dubbed Arlington Hall. Earlier, they'd cracked Japanese codes. In 1943, Clark turned his wizards loose on intercepted Soviet cable traffic. The top-secret project was codenamed Venona. Laboriously poring over hundreds of thousands of Soviet cables, Clark's wizards managed to decode about 3,000 of them. Even that paltry number revealed a shocking truth. The Venona decrypts uncovered hundreds of Soviet agents and informants disguised behind a bewildering array of code names, some identifiable, some not. Among them were a top U.S. spy official, Duncan Lee, as well as the Ukrainian-American cryptanalyst Bill Weisband, a New York congressman, Samuel Dickstein, a State Department economist, Loris Dugin, and a top Treasury official, Harry Dexter White. Other clues pointed to presidential advisor Harry Hopkins. Perhaps most disturbing was evidence that communist agents had infiltrated America's secret of secrets, the Atomic Manhattan Project. Venona provided evidence against two of these spies, relatively minor ones, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. But because Venona had to be kept hidden, the evidence of their guilt could never be presented in court. The Soviets, thanks to their man Weisband, the cryptanalyst, learned in 1945 that their codes were compromised and took countermeasures. As with most secret societies, the downfall of the communist clandestine apparatus in the United States ultimately came from two disaffected initiates. Party members and Soviet agents Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley both spilled their guts to the FBI. Chambers, in fact, had decided to defect in 1939, but couldn't find anybody in Washington interested in what he had to say. Soviet espionage and clandestine communist activity didn't stop after the late 1940s, but arguably never again attained the same level of free rein. In the 1950s, the American Communist Party became infested with FBI informants and withered to insignificance. Communist success had always depended on secret society techniques, selective recruitment, rigorous discipline, and fanatical loyalty. The party still had loyal comrades, but years of Stalinist tyranny, factional infighting, and flip-flop orders from the Comintern had taken a toll. A secret society can survive the loss of initiates, but it can never survive the loss of their faith.